Welcome to the Infrastructure Show. I'm your host, Professor Joseph Schoffer, and I'm the director of Northwestern University's Infrastructure Technology Institute.
And I'm your co-host, Tom Herman.
The Infrastructure Show is designed to present to listeners the reality of America's infrastructure, its condition, why it is the way it is, and what can be done about it.
Alaskan Way is a street along Seattle's waterfront, above which is the elevated Alaskan Way Viaduct. This double-deck roadway, completed in 1959, was damaged by the 2001 Nisqually earthquake, as was the nearby Elliott Bay seawall. Emergency repairs were undertaken by the state of Washington, but for the long term, the state, King County, and the city of Seattle agreed that the viaduct had reached the end of its useful life and needed to be replaced.
Instead of building a new viaduct, it is being replaced with a bored tunnel beneath downtown in a massive public infrastructure project constructed in the center of this large city. With us today to discuss this project is Linnea Laird of the Washington State Department of Transportation, who is administrator of the Alaskan Way Viaduct Replacement Program. Linnea, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, you're very welcome. I always appreciate the opportunity to talk about the project and share what's going on out here.
Well, that's great. So maybe as a starting point, can you help us understand just why it's necessary to replace the Alaskan Way Viaduct? Tell us something about its current condition and why repair and reconstruction isn't the preferred option?
Sure. So the Alaskan Way Viaduct was opened back in the late 1950s. And since that time, it's had decades of wear and use on it. And if you happened to look very closely at it, you would see some of the vulnerabilities that exist right now on the structure. You will see crumbling concrete. You will see exposed rebar. You will see some weakened connections and cracking where the thing connects, deteriorated railing. You would also observe the structure itself. It's got narrow lanes. It has virtually no shoulders. It's got very, very limited overhead clearance on it. And we also have a significant weight restriction in place because it wasn't designed for what we see as current truck standards. But the real highlight was when we had this 2001 Nisqually earthquake, it really showed some of the weaknesses that are in the facility itself. And we've had areas of the viaduct that have settled as much as 5.5 inches. And that in itself has created some very weak areas of the overall viaduct. So while it's done a great job for us over the years, there's a number of things that really make the structure vulnerable, both from a wear and tear perspective, from a future of transportation, and then from any kind of seismic event.
What was the basis of a choice of doing a tunnel to replace it rather than a new elevated structure?
We went through many, many evaluations as far as the right replacement structure, and we did look at elevated structures. We looked at cut and cover structures. And we looked at actually surface street options. The bored tunnel was actually a latecomer to the game. And why it was ultimately chosen was because of where this viaduct is located. It's right down on the waterfront. It's got businesses on both sides of it. It carries close to 100,000 vehicles a day. There is no good alternate route for putting vehicles anywhere else, and the disruption from the construction itself and the replacement and the impact that would have on businesses was a huge driver in ultimately choosing what was the right solution to replace the viaduct. So we were looking for something that could manage the traffic and that would result in less construction impacts and actually be done quicker than what we thought we could build an elevated structure with all of the different kinds of construction issues down on the waterfront.
I understand that the choice of the design option, the tunnel versus surface versus elevated, created some controversy. What were the issues that people were concerned about?
Well, speaking about the controversy, it was a 10-year-long controversy with lots of briefings, public meetings, thousands of public comments and stakeholder groups, and two votes. Tunnels have a mystique and fear about them. Even though the Seattle area has many, many tunnels, there is a lot of fear about the cost of a tunnel. And we're a very urbanized area. So you look around and you look at all of the buildings and the cost factors and the fact that there was a whole lot of media about the big dig. And there are people, truly, that actually love the viaduct. If you drive on the viaduct, you have a fabulous view of the Olympics and the water. So there's just a lot of different reasons that folks had about where their choice would land on the project.
How does the tunnel compare with elevated and surface options that you looked at in terms of cost and traffic performance and in terms of earthquake resistance?
From a cost perspective, a tunnel is more than an elevated structure. But from a constructability perspective in this urban area, the tunnel could be completed for a lot less construction impacts than what we would see for replacing the viaduct. We were not sure that we could actually keep the businesses viable down in the waterfront area itself, nor did we have a good solution for how to actually manage the traffic itself. And what the tunnel allows us to do is actually keep the viaduct in play, keep traffic moving, well, we can move forward and create this different route. We will be building, it's a double-deck tunnel structure. The existing viaduct carries over 100,000 vehicles a day. The bored tunnel is expected to only carry in the 60,000 vehicles a day, but it doesn't have the on and off ramps. The on and off ramps are in each end of it. The viaduct has, it acts more like a collector distributor within the city. So it's got a little bit different use and purpose. As far as seismic standards, we would build and both of them, well, the bridge would have been built to current seismic standards, as will the tunnel. So from a seismic performance standpoint, they both would meet current standards. Tunnels actually perform very, very well from earthquakes because they're in the ground, they move with the soil, and so you don't have that the same kind of resistance that you get from an above ground structure.
Which is counterintuitive because most people probably say that last place I want to be in an earthquake is in a tunnel, but that's a fear that you must have had to educate people about.
We've done a lot of talking about that and a lot of studying on this issue, but if you look around the world too at the various places that have had large seismic events, the tunnels are the facilities that they get up and running the quickest when there's been damage. So, and we've also have many other tunnels in the area, some of them over 100 years old, and they've all performed remarkably well in the seismic events that we've had in this area.
So are there any special design features that you need to build into the tunnel to ensure its safety during an earthquake?
It's not so much during an earthquake. I mean, we certainly pay attention to that. We look at the connections between the portal areas in the tunnel itself. We look at the maximum deflection that we would have between the liner segments. And even with a 2,500-year event, we're only looking at an inch and a quarter deflection along its axis. So you certainly look towards reinforcing. You certainly look to the connections between the rings themselves, and then how your portal structures enter into the tunnel and how it behaves. So we've looked at all of that, and we're very confident that our tunnel will meet the seismic standards.
So when you talk about the rings, that's the tunnel liner that you're really speaking about?
Yes.
Right? And is that a concrete structure?
It will be. We will have a each ring is about 6 feet, I guess you would say, in along its circumference. Not its circumference, longitudinally. They're 6 feet wide, and there's 10 rings that will make up the diameter of our tunnel.
And what is the diameter of the finished tunnel?
The tunnel is just under 58 feet, and from an interior, it's just over 56 feet on an interior. So very, very large double deck.
So it's double deck, and how many lanes in each deck?
It's got two lanes on each deck area. We've got a standard shoulder of 8 foot and then a narrow shoulder. The overall length of the tunnel is just under 2 miles. It's like 1.9 miles long. So, and it's a single bore. That's one of the reasons that the tunnel project actually became economical to us, is that we were able to come up with a feasible size of a single bore to manage it. It was really one of the things that was unique about this was at the time, it was the largest bored tunnel in the world. And so the tunnel industry, if you pay attention to it, the technology kind of goes in leaps and bounds. And we were taking one more leap at the time in going to this size of diameter tunnel. But since then, there's one that's even larger that's in the planning stages in Russia.
What does the tunnel boring machine look like? How big is it? What kind of machine is it?
Oh, it's huge. The overall length of the tunnel boring machine is about 330 feet long. It weighs 5,500 tons. It has, I guess, four key components to it, from the cutting head to then different segments of trailing gear on it. The thing will be, it's actually being manufactured and designed in Japan, and then it will come over to us on a ship, and then it will be transported to the portal site, and the launch pit itself is going to be close to 100 feet deep where we actually launch the TBM.
And then you just send it in there like a mole, and it digs its way straight through?
It does. Its face rotates, and it's got this cutter head and spokes on it, and brings the soil material in through the face, and then it gets conveyed out the length of the tunnel, and it propels itself by pushing on thrusting jacks off of these ring segments. So it's a very self-contained operation, in that the rings get transported into the TBM machine, they get lifted and put in place, and then it moves itself forward by pushing against that ring segment, then it pulls the jacks back, you put another ring segment in place, and you push again and go. So a very self-contained operation, but it's very, very complicated too, as far as driving. It's not like you can see where you're going. You really have to pay attention to instrumentation.
Are you anxious to drive it? Are you going to get behind the wheel and drive it?
Oh, I think they'd be silly to put me behind the wheel and drive this. I actually want a really, really qualified driver on this TBM.
In effect, you build it on site. Is that correct?
Yeah, they build the TBM, they fabricate it, and they construct it and test it, just with factory testing, over in Japan. Then they tear it apart into large shipping pieces and then ship it over here. And then they put it back together again and then get ready to go.
What is the nature of the material? I mean, is it hard rock drilling or soft ground?
No, this is soft ground. This will be earth pressure balance machine. We have a tremendous mix of materials, from clays, silt, sands, glacial tills. And one of the reasons that I didn't mention earlier why the viaduct is so vulnerable is that there's a lot of loose fill materials right at the surface. And so the surface of the soils right down in the viaduct area have very little good soil structure to it. And so we're going to quickly get below those and get into the harder glacial trails.
So if I understand correctly, when you use the phrase, I think, earth pressure balance, so what you really need to do is hold back the earth until you get the tunnel liner in, and the tunnel boring machine actually does that job for you. Is that correct?
Yes, it does. It does.
So that would be different if you went to the other end of the country and you're boring under Manhattan, where you've got rock close to the surface. Once you drill the hole, you don't really worry that much about holding back the pressure because the rock is very strong.
Yes, your liner sections, and then you grout behind that, because the shield that actually does the face shield on the machine is a little bit bigger than the liner sections. So you place these liner sections and then you grout behind them so that you do have the pressure of the earth closely in contact to all the liner sections, and minimize the potential for voids and any of that earth continuing to settle and move.
What's the technology that you use to keep the tunnel on track, to make sure that the drill tunnel is exactly where you want it to be?
Well, they have instrumentations with measurements already set in it as far as the alignment.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have targets that they place throughout the tunnel, and they validate it in a couple of different ways from actually surveying where they're at and checking. The other thing that we do is not only do we care where the tunnel is at and what it's doing, we care about the results and what we're seeing at the surface of the ground as far as any kind of deformation or settlement. We're going to be tunneling under 157 different buildings that could be affected by this work. So we really care not only where it's at, but what is happening all along the way. So instrumentation on this project is really critical, both on looking at the streets and all of the facilities that are going to be impacted.
So you need to track what's going on with the buildings on the surface to make sure you don't do damage to them.
That's right. That's right. We're always paying attention to what is happening. We instrument lots of instrumentation within the machine itself. We pay a lot of attention to what's the pressure. Are we always keeping the soil pressure balanced as we go so that we're not creating voids and we're not excavating too much soil? There's a real art and science in doing this well. And every single TBM or new TBM comes out with new bells and whistles and new approaches to try to manage those situations.
How long will it take once the borer is in the pit and ready to start? How long will it take for it to bore the tunnel?
We're estimating that it's going to be close to 14 months before we hole through on the other end.
And you're excited to see it come out on the other end?
Oh, I think there's going to be a tremendous celebration when we bore this tunnel through. So we're very excited to be at this stage in the project. The machine has been ordered. It's in final design and starting to fabricate some of the pieces. We've started a little bit of early construction. I mean, to get ready for the TBM, and it's not scheduled to be delivered on site to mid-2013, we have a tremendous amount of work to do just to get ready for it and to get the facilities in place that we can actually launch it.
So what happens when the tunnel boring machine bores through and you open up that tunnel? Can that machine be salvaged? Can it be reused or sold to some other project?
Yes. The contractor actually owns the TBM, and they make decisions as they go. But many, many of the TBMs have done multiple projects around the world. So it just depends. This one is sized a little bit uniquely. I mean, many of the tunnels are similar sizes from transit to utilities. This is a pretty big one. So how quickly it will get put in play depends on what kind of project there is that would support its use.
And the way you described it, if I understood correctly, as the machine's going along, it's sort of putting these 6-foot sections in place. So when the machine pops out, how close is the tunnel to being complete and ready to use?
Well, so that's just the liner segments. And let me tell you what each one of these liner segments is like. I mean, on average, they're 12 feet long, 6 feet wide, and they're over 2 foot thick. So each segment, and we have 10 of these segments that make up a ring, that's the size of these segments that they lift into place in forming this. So that will be finished. What has to follow is, well, this is a double deck structure. So we have to build the interior structures, and it's like building a bridge throughout the length, this 2-mile length of the tunnel. We have emergency walkways for pedestrians that will go end-to-end. We've got all of the systems to put in play, from cameras to sprinklers to air, lighting, water, you name it. We've got to get all of those in play. Now, some of this work will be going on as we're boring the tunnel, but there is a conflict between getting materials in and soils out and then building it out. So we still have quite a bit of work ahead of us to get the tunnel actually completed and open for traffic.
So will the liner segments be, they'll be precast, will they be cast on site or trucked in from far away?
They're looking at a couple of different options in the Tacoma Puyallup area, so probably within a 30 to 40 mile range is what they're looking at for a precast yard.
And what's the average progress per day that you're expecting?
Startup time will be very slow. We're expecting to get one ring a day, which is 6 feet. That will transition to 12, and then we'll go to 30, maybe 40.
40 in a day?
It's a day.
Wow.
So on a good day, a really good day, and a day is 24 hours long, though we won't be, you know, for some of the day, you're actually not moving forward because you're either putting the rings in play or pushing off or doing maintenance, or maybe an inner, you know, some type of replacement of equipment or tools. So it's not a really fast operation, which is why it takes 14 months to bore for this just under 2 mile section.
And you mentioned you're expecting delivery of the machine in 2013, then the 14 months of boring, and then of course all of the work to build the interior, as you described it. What's your target date for the first use of it with everything being ready?
So we're expecting the tunnel to be completed in very late 2015. I think it's like December 21st of 2015. And then there's some connecting work that actually needs to be done. So it'll be late 2015, early 2016 before we actually open it to traffic.
So then the viaduct stays in place until the new section is open?
It does. It does. That is one of the beauties of doing this bored tunnel on the alignment that we've got. It is that we're able to, with the exception of a few, you know, closures to accommodate some significant construction, we can keep traffic moving on the existing viaduct.
Is there anything you have to do of anything substantial that you have to do to ensure the integrity of the viaduct while you're building the tunnel?
So we have been doing that since the Nisqually earthquake. The structure's on a very aggressive preservation review, and we have crews that come out and actually expect and do an end-to-end inspection generally between 2 and 4 times a year, where we close it down for a weekend and then look at everything we possibly can. We've got crack meters and gauges. We've done some emergency contracts in the past, say like micropiles, to try to prevent certain areas from continued settlement, or we do crack repairs or different things. So we will continue that kind of look at the viaduct as we move into construction and beyond.
So how much does this, the new tunnel, cost, and how are you paying for it?
So the tunnel is a series of multiple contracts, and for all of the contracts to open it end-to-end is just under $2 billion. The boring design-build projects that we have with our tunneling contractor, Seattle Tunnel Partners, is about $1.5 billion for that contract. The funding sources, it's a mix. The majority of the funds are actually state funds. We have some federal funds on the project. We have some local funds on the project. And we're relying on up to $400 million in bonds to be reimbursed by tolls and some local funds as well.
So it'll be a toll facility?
It will be a toll facility.
And will you use automated toll collection?
We will.
And is that connected? I understand that talking about tolling for the replacement of the 520 bridge across Lake Washington will be in the same toll collection system?
Yes, it will. Yeah. It will be a similar one, whether it's, I don't know that it'll be the exact same. Ours will go into play about 5 years after that one is, and usually there's certain technology developments that may occur, but it's the same profile of system, but electronic tolling only.
Yeah, you would expect the same technology on both, presumably.
Has any decision been made about who's going to be the first person to drive through it when it's done, and will that be you?
Well, we have not made that decision. I would imagine that I will, in fact, get to walk or drive it multiple times before we actually open it.
Right.
But on the opening day, it's generally not the folks that constructed it that get to drive it first.
Isn't it interesting the way that happens?
It is, isn't it?
You've given us a really good description of this project. I'm anxious to get out to Seattle again to get a close-up view of it. I know we'll all be watching you as you make progress. We thank you very much for describing this to us, and we wish you a very successful project, and perhaps in a few years we'll give you another call and see how things are going.
Well, thank you, and if you get out here, come and look us up. We'd love to show it to you.
You can count on that. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Okay.